New York City, March 10th, 2014. 6. There is a rhythm to moving through the world alone. You discover what you can and cannot live without, the simple necessities and small joys that define a life. Not food, not shelter, not the basic things a body needs, those are, for her, a luxury, but the things that keep you sane, that bring you joy, that make life bearable. Addie thinks of her father and his carvings, the way he peeled away the bark, whittled down the wood beneath to find the shapes that lived inside. Michelangelo called it the angel in the marble, though she'd not known that as a child. Her father had called it a secret in the wood. He knew how to reduce a thing, sliver by sliver, piece by piece, until he found its essence. Knew, too, when he'd gone too far. One stroke too many, and the wood went from delicate to brittle in his hands. Addie has had 300 years to practice her father's art, to whittle herself down to a few essential truths, to learn the things she cannot do without. And this is what she's settled on. She can go without food. She will not wither. She can go without heat. The cold will not kill her. But a life without art, without wonder, without beautiful things, she would go mad. She has gone mad. What she needs are stories. Stories are a way to preserve oneself, to be remembered, and to forget. Stories come in so many forms, in charcoal and in song, in paintings, poems, films, and books. Books, she has found, are a way to live a thousand lives, or to find strength in a very long one. Two blocks up Flatbush, she sees the familiar green folding table on the sidewalk, covered in paperbacks, and Fred, hunched in his rickety chair behind it, red nose buried in M is for Malice. The old man explained to her once, back when he was on K is for Killer, how he was determined to get through Grafton's entire alphabet series before he dies. She hopes he makes it. He has a nagging cough, and sitting out there in the cold doesn't help, but here he is whenever Addie comes by. Fred doesn't smile or make small talk. What Addie knows of him, she has pried out word by word over the last 2 years, the progress slow and halting. She knows he is a widower who lives upstairs, knows the books belong to his wife, Candace, knows that when she died, he packed up all her books and brought them down to sell, and it's like letting her go in pieces, selling off his grief. Addie knows that he sits down here because he's afraid of dying in his apartment, of not being found, not being missed.
"I keel over out here," he says. "At least someone will notice."
He is a gruff old man, but Addie likes him, sees the sadness in his anger, the guardedness of grief. Addie suspects he doesn't really want the books to sell. He doesn't price them, hasn't read more than a few, and sometimes his mood is so coarse, his tone so cold, he actually scares the customers away. Still, they come, and still they buy, but every time the selection seems to thin, a new box appears, the contents are unpacked to fill the gaps, and in the last few weeks, Addie has once more begun to spot new releases among the old, fresh covers and unbroken spines in with the battered paperbacks. She wonders if he is buying them, or if other people have begun donating to his strange collection. Addie slows now, her fingers dancing over the spines. The selection is always a medley of discordant notes. Thrillers, biographies, romance, battered mass markets mostly, interrupted by a few glossy hardcovers. She has stopped to study them 100 times, but today she simply tips the book on the end into her hand, the gesture light and swift as a magician's, a piece of legerdemain. Practice long given way to perfect. Addie tucks the book under her arm and keeps walking. The old man never looks up. New York City, March 10th, 2014. 7. The market sits like a cluster of old wives at the edge of the park. Long thin from winter, the number of white-capped stalls is finally beginning to swell again, drops of color dotting the square where new produce springs up between the root vegetables, meat, and bread, and other staples resistant to the cold. Addie weaves between the people, heading to the little white tent nestled by the front gates of Prospect. Rise and Shine is a coffee and pastry stall run by a pair of sisters that remind Addie of Estelle, if the old woman had been two instead of one, divided along the lines of temper. If she had been kinder, softer, or perhaps if she had simply lived another life, another time. The sisters are here year-round, come snow or sun, a small constant in an ever-changing city. "Hey, sugar," says Mel, all broad shoulders and wild curls and the kind of sweetness that makes strangers feel like family. Addie loves that, the easy warmth, wants to nestle into it like a well-worn sweater. "What can we get for you?" asks Maggie, older, leaner, laugh lines around her eyes belying the idea she rarely smiles. Addie orders a large coffee and two muffins, one blueberry and the other chocolate chip, and then hands over a crumpled 10 that she'd found on Toby's coffee table. She could steal something from the market, of course, but she likes this little stand and the two women who run it. "Got a dime?" Maggie asks. Addie digs the change from her pocket, coming up with a few quarters, a nickel, and there it is again, warm among the cold metal coins. Her fingers graze the wooden ring, and she clenches her teeth at the feel of it, like a nagging thought impossible to shed. Sifting through the coins, Addie is careful not to touch the wooden band again as she searches her change, resists the urge to fling the ring into the weeds, knows it will not make a difference if she does. It will always find its way back. The darkness whispers in her ear, arms wrapped like a scarf around her throat. "I am always with you." Addie plucks out a dime and pockets the rest. Maggie hands back $4.
"Where you from, doll?"
asks Mel, noticing the faintest edge of an accent in the corners of Addie's voice, reduced these days to the vanishing end of an S, the slight softening of a T. It has been so long, and yet she cannot seem to let it go.
"Here and there," she says. "But I was born in France."
"Oh la la," says Mel in her flat Brooklyn drawl.
"Here you go, sunshine,"
says Maggie, passing her a bag of pastries and a tall cup. Addie curls her fingers around the paper, relishing the heat on her cold palms. The coffee is strong and dark, and when she takes a sip, she feels the warmth all the way down, and she is back in Paris again, in Istanbul, in Naples. A mouthful of memories. She starts toward the park gates.
"Au revoir,"
calls Mel, landing hard on every letter, and Addie smiles into the steam. The air is crisp inside the park. The sun is out, fighting for warmth, but the shade still belongs to winter, so Addie follows the light, sinking onto a grassy slope beneath the cloudless sky. She sits the blueberry muffin on top of the paper bag and sips her coffee, examining the book she borrowed from Fred's table. She hadn't bothered to look at what she was taking, but now her heart sinks a little at the sight of the paperback, the cover soft with wear, the title in German. "Kinder und Hausmärchen," it reads, by Brüder Grimm. Grimm's Fairy Tales. Her German is rusty, kept in the back of her mind, in a corner she hasn't used much since the war. Now she dusts it off, knows that beneath the layer of grime she will find the space intact, undisturbed, the boon of memory. She turns through the fragile old pages, eyes tripping over the words. Once upon a time, she loved this kind of story. When she was still a child, and the world was small, and she dreamed of open doors. But Addie knows too well now, knows that these stories are full of foolish humans doing foolish things, warning tales of gods and monsters and greedy mortals who want too much and then fail to understand what they've lost. Until the price is paid,
and it's too late to claim it back. A voice rises like smoke inside her chest. Never pray to the gods who answer after dark. Addie tosses the book aside and slumps back into the grass, closing her eyes as she tries to savor the sun. Villon-sur-Sault, France, July 29th, 1714. 8. Adeline had wanted to be a tree. To grow wild and deep, belong to no one but the ground beneath her feet and the sky above, just like Estelle. It would be an unconventional life, and perhaps a little lonely, but at least it would be hers. She would belong to no one but herself. But here is the danger of a place like Villon. Blink, and a year is gone. Blink, and five more follow. It is like a gap between stones, this village, just wide enough for things to get lost. The kind of place where time slips and blurs, where a month, a year, a life can go missing, where everyone is born and buried in the same 10-meter plot. Adeline was going to be a tree. But then came Roger and his wife Paulina, grown up together and then married and then gone in the time it took for her to lace up a pair of boots. A hard pregnancy, a ruinous birth, two deaths instead of one new life. Three small children left behind where there should have been four. The earth still fresh over a grave, and Roger looking for another wife, a mother for his children, a second life at the cost of Adeline's one and only. Of course, she said no. Adeline is 23, already too old to be wed. 23, a third of a life already buried. 23, and then gifted like a prize sow to a man she does not love or want or even know. She said no, and learned how much the word was worth. Learned that, like Estelle, she had promised herself to the village, and the village had a need. Her mother said it was duty. Her father said it was mercy, though Adeline didn't know for whom. Estelle said nothing, because she knew it wasn't fair, knew this was the risk of being a woman, of giving yourself to a place instead of a person. Adeline was going to be a tree, and instead, people have come brandishing an axe. They have given her away. She lies awake the night before the wedding and thinks of freedom, of fleeing, of stealing away on her father's horse, even as she knows the thought is madness. She feels mad enough to do it. Instead, she prays. She has been praying, of course, since the day of her betrothal, given half her possessions to the river and buried the other half in the field or at the slope of dirt and brush where the village meets the woods, and now she is almost out of time and out of tokens. She lies there in the dark, twists the old wooden ring on its leather cord, and considers going out and praying again now in the dead of night. But Adeline remembers Estelle's fearsome warning about the ones who might answer. So instead, she clenches her hands together and prays to her mother's God instead, prays for help, for a miracle, for a way out. And then, in the darkest part of night, she prays for Roger's death, anything for her escape. She feels guilty at once, sucks it back into her chest like an expelled breath, and waits. Day breaks like an egg yolk, spilling yellow light across the field. Adeline slips out of the house before dawn, having never slept at all. Now she winds her way through the wild grass beyond the vegetable garden, skirts wicking up the dew. She lets herself sink with the weight of them, her favorite drawing pencil clutched in one hand. Adeline does not want to give it up, but she is running out of time and out of tokens. She presses the pencil point down into the damp soil of the field. Help me, she whispers to the grass, its edges limned with light. I know you are there. I know you are listening. Please, please. But the grass is only grass, and the wind is only wind, and neither answers, even when she presses her forehead to the ground and sobs. There is nothing wrong with Roger. But there is nothing right either. His skin is waxy, his blonde hair thinning, his voice like a wisp of wind. When his hand lays itself upon her arm, the grip is weak, and when he inclines his head toward hers, his breath is stale. And Adeline? She is a vegetable left too long in the garden, its skin gone stiff, its insides woody, gone to ground by choice, only to be dug up and made into a meal.
I do not want to marry him,
she says, fingers tangled in the weedy earth.
Adeline,
calls her mother, as if she is one of the livestock gone astray. She drags herself up, empty with anger and grief, and when she goes inside, her mother sees only the dirt caking her hands and orders her daughter to the basin. Adeline scrubs the soil from beneath her nails, bristles biting her fingers as her mother scolds.
What will your husband think?
Husband. A word like a millstone, all weight and no warmth. Her mother tuts.
You will not be so restless once you have children to tend.
Adeline thinks again of Isabel, two small boys clinging to her skirts, a third in a basket by the hearth. They used to dream together, but she has aged 10 years in two, it seems. She is always tired, and there are hollows in her face where once her cheeks were red from laughter.
It will be good for you, says her mother, to be somebody's wife.
The day passes like a sentence. The sun falls like a scythe. Adeline can almost hear the whistle of the blade as her mother braids her hair into a crown, weaves flowers in the place of jewels. Her dress is simple and light, but it might as well be made of mail for how it weighs on her. She wants to scream. Instead, she reaches up and grips the wooden ring around her neck as if for balance.
You must take that off before the ceremony,
instructs her mother, and Adeline nods, even as her fingers tighten around it. Her father comes in from the barn, dusted with wood shavings and smelling of sap. He coughs, a faint rattle, like loose seeds inside his chest. It has been there for a year, that cough, but he will not let them talk of it.
You are almost ready?
He asks. What a foolish question. Her mother talks about the wedding dinner as if it had already come and gone. Adeline looks out the window at the sinking sun and doesn't listen to the words, but she can hear the light in her mother's voice, the vindication in it. Even in her father's eyes, there is a measure of relief. Their daughter tried to carve her own road, but now things are being set right. A wayward life dragged back on course, propelled down its proper path. The house is too warm, the air heavy and still, and Adeline cannot breathe. Finally, the church bell tolls, the same low tone it calls at funerals, and she forces herself to her feet. Her father touches her arm. His face is sorry, but his grip is firm.
You will come to love your husband,
he says, but the words are clearly more wish than promise.
You will be a good wife,
says her mother, and hers are more command than wish. And then Estelle appears in the doorway, dressed as if she is in mourning. And why shouldn't she be? This woman who taught her of wild dreams and willful gods, who filled Adeline's head with thoughts of freedom, blew on the embers of hope, and let her believe a life could be her own. The light has gone watery and thin behind Estelle's gray head. There is still time, Adeline tells herself, but it is fleeting, faster now with every breath. Time. How often has she heard it described as sand within a glass, steady, constant? But that is a lie, because she can feel it quicken, crashing toward her. Panic beats a drum inside her chest, and outside, the path is a single dark line, stretched straight and narrow toward the village square. On the other side, the church stands waiting, pale and stiff as a tombstone, and she knows that if she walks in, she will not come out. Her future will rush by the same as her past, only worse, because there will be no freedom, only a marriage bed and a deathbed and perhaps a childbed between, and when she dies, it will be as though she never lived. There will be no Paris, no green-eyed lover, no trips on boats to faraway lands, no foreign skies, no life beyond this village, no life at all, unless... Adeline pulls free of her father's grip, drags to a stop on the path. Her mother turns to look at her, as if she might run, which is exactly what she wants to do, but knows she can't. "I made a gift for my husband," says Adeline, mind spinning. "I've left it in the house." Her mother softens, approving. Her father stiffens, suspicious. Estelle's eyes narrow, knowing. "I'll just fetch it," she continues, already turning back.
"I'll go with you," says her father, and her heart lurches and her fingers twitch, but it is Estelle who reaches out to stop him.
"Jean," she says in that sly way, "Adeline cannot be your daughter and his wife. She is a woman grown, not a child to be minded."
He finds his daughter's eyes and says,
"Be quick."
Adeline has already taken flight, back up the path and past the door, into the house and through to the other side, to the open window and the field and the distant line of trees, the woods standing sentinel at the eastern edge of the village, opposite the sun, the woods already cloaked in shadow, though she knows there is still light, still time.
"Adeline,"
calls her father, but she doesn't look back. Instead, she climbs through the window, wood snagging on the wedding dress as she stumbles out and runs.
"Adeline! Adeline!"
The voices call out after her, but they stretch thinner with every step, and soon she is across the field and into the woods, breaking the line of trees as she sinks to her knees in the dense summer dirt. She clutches the wooden ring, feels the loss of it even before she tugs the leather cord over her head. Adeline does not want to sacrifice it, but she has used up all her tokens, given every gift she could spare back to the earth, and none of the gods have answered. Now this is all she has left, and the light is thin, and the village is calling, and she is desperate to escape.
"Please,"
she whispers, her voice breaking over the word as she plunges the band down into the mossy earth.
"I will do anything."
The trees murmur overhead, and then go still, as if they too are waiting, and Adeline prays to every god in the Vion woods, to anyone and anything who will listen. This cannot be her life. This cannot be all there is.
"Answer me,"
she pleads as the damp seeps into her wedding dress. She squeezes her eyes shut and strains to hear, but the only sound is her own voice on the wind and her name echoing in her ears like a heartbeat.
"Adeline! Adeline! Adeline!"
She bows her head against the soil and grips the dark earth and screams,
"Answer me!"
The silence is mocking. She has lived here all her life and never heard the woods this quiet. Cold settles over her, and she doesn't know if it's coming from the forest or from her own bones, giving up the last of their fight. Her eyes are still shut tight, and perhaps that is why she doesn't notice that the sun has slipped behind the village at her back, that dusk has given way to dark. Adeline keeps praying and doesn't notice at all. Vion-sur-Sarthe, France, July 29th, 1714. 9. The sound, when it comes, is a low rumble, deep and distant as thunder. Laughter, Adeline thinks, opening her eyes and noticing, finally, how the light has faded. She looks up, but sees nothing.
"Hello?"
The laughter draws itself into a voice, somewhere behind her.
"You need not kneel," it says. "Let us see you on your feet."
She scrambles up and turns, but she is met only by darkness, surrounded by it, a moonless night after the summer sun has fled, and Adeline knows then that she has made a mistake, that this is one of the gods she was warned against.
"Adeline! Adeline!"
call the voices from the town, as faint and far away as the wind. She squints into the shadows between the trees, but there is no shape, no god to be found, only that voice, close as a breath against her cheek.
"Adeline? Adeline?"
it says, mocking.
"They are calling for you."
She turns again, finding nothing but deep shadow.
Show yourself,
she orders, her own voice sharp and brittle as a stick. Something brushes her shoulder, grazes her wrist, drapes itself around her like a lover. Adeline swallows.
What are you?
The shadow's touch withdraws.
What am I?
It asks, an edge of humor in that velvet tone.
That depends on what you believe.
The voice splits, doubles, rattling through tree limbs and snaking over moss, folding over on itself until it is everywhere.
So tell me, tell me, tell me,
it echoes.
Am I the devil, or the dark, dark, dark? Am I a monster, monster, or a god, 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 or...
The shadows in the woods begin to pull together, drawn like storm clouds. But when they settle, the edges are no longer wisps of smoke, but hard lines, the shape of a man, made firm by the light of the village lanterns at his back.
Or am I this?
The voice spills from a perfect pair of lips, a shadow revealing emerald eyes that dance below black brows, black hair that curls across his forehead, framing a face that Adeline knows too well, one that she has conjured up 1,000 times in pencil and charcoal and dream. It is the stranger, her stranger. She knows it is a trick, a shadow parading as a man, but the sight of him still robs her breath. The darkness looks down at his shape, seeing himself as if for the first time, and seems to approve.
Ah, so the girl believes in something after all.
Those green eyes lift.
Well now, he says, you have called, and I have come.
Never pray to the gods that answer after dark. Adeline knows, she knows, but this is the one who answered, the only one who would help.
Are you prepared to pay?
Pay. The price. The ring. Adeline drops to her knees, scours the ground until she finds the leather cord and frees her father's ring from the soil. She holds it out to the god, its pale wood now stained with dirt, and he draws closer. He may look like flesh and blood, but he still moves like shadow. A single step, and he is there, filling her vision, folding one hand around the ring and resting the other on Adeline's cheek. His thumb brushes the freckle beneath her eye, the edge of her stars.
My dear, says the darkness, taking the ring, I do not deal in trinkets.
The wooden band crumbles in his hand and falls away, nothing more than smoke. A strangled sound escapes her lips. It hurt enough to lose the ring, hurts more to see it wiped from the world like a smudge on skin. But if the ring is not enough, then what?
Please, she says, I would give anything.
The shadow's other hand still rests against her cheek.
You assume I want anything,
he says, lifting her chin.
But I take only one coin.
He leans closer still, green eyes impossibly bright, his voice soft as silk.
The deals I make for souls.
Adeline's heart lurches in her chest. In her mind, she sees her mother on her knees in church, speaking of God and heaven, hears her father talking, telling stories of wishes and riddles. She thinks of Estelle, who believes in nothing but a tree over her bones, who would say that a soul is nothing more than a seed returned to soil, though she's the one who warned against the dark.
Adeline,
says the darkness, her name sliding like moss between his teeth.
I am here. Now tell me why.
She has waited so long to be met, to be answered, to be asked, that at first the words all fail her.
I do not want to marry.
She feels so small when she says it. Her whole life feels small, and she sees that judgment reflected in the god's gaze, as if to say, is that all?
And no, it is more than that. Of course it is more. I do not want to belong to someone else, she says with sudden vehemence.
The words are a door flung wide, and now the rest pour out of her.
I do not want to belong to anyone but myself. I want to be free, free to live and to find my own way, to love or to be alone, but at least it is my choice, and I am so tired of not having choices, so scared of the years rushing past beneath my feet. I do not want to die as I've lived, which is no life at all.
The shadow cuts her off, impatient.
What use is it to tell me what you do not want?
His hand slides through her hair, comes to rest against the back of her neck, drawing her close.
Tell me instead what you want most.
She looks up.
I want a chance to live. I want to be free.
She thinks of the years slipping by. Blink and half your life is gone.
I want more time.
He considers her, those green eyes changing shade, now spring grass, now summer leaf.
How long?
Her mind spins. 50 years, 100, every number feels too small.
Ah,
says the darkness, reading her silence.
You do not know.
Again, the green eyes shift, darken.
You ask for time without limit. You want freedom without rule. You want to be untethered. You want to live exactly as you please.
Yes,
says Adeline, breathless with want. But the shadow's expression sours. His hand drops from her skin, and then he is no longer there, but leaning against a tree several strides away.
I decline, he says.
Adeline draws back as if struck.
What?
She has come this far, has given everything she has. She made her choice. She cannot go back to that world, that life, that present and past without a future.
You cannot decline.
One dark brow lifts, but there is no amusement in that face.
I am not some genie bound to your whim.
He pushes off the tree.
Nor am I some petty forest spirit, content with granting favors for mortal trinkets. I am stronger than your god and older than your devil. I am the darkness between stars and the roots beneath the earth. I am promise and potential, and when it comes to playing games, I divine the rules, I set the pieces, and I choose when to play. And tonight, I say no.
Adeline? 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 Beyond the edge of the woods, the village lights are closer now. There are torches in the field. They are coming for her. The shadow looks over his shoulder.
Go home, Adeline. Back to your small life.
Why?
She pleads, grabbing his arm.
Why do you refuse me?
He brushes his hand along her cheek, the gesture soft and warm as hearth smoke.
I am not in the business of charity. You ask for too much. How many years until you're sated? How many until I get my due? No, I make deals with endings, and yours has none.
She will come back to this moment 1,000 times. In frustration and regret, in sorrow and self-pity and unbridled rage. She will come to face the fact that she cursed herself before he ever did. But here and now, all she can see is the flickering torchlight of Villon and the green eyes of the stranger she once dreamed of loving and the chance to escape slipping away with his touch.
You want an ending?
She says.
Then take my life when I am done with it. You can have my soul when I don't want it anymore.
The shadow tips his head. Suddenly intrigued. A smile, just like the smile in her drawings, askance and full of secrets, crosses his mouth. And then he pulls her to him, a lover's embrace. He is smoke and skin, air and bone, and when his mouth presses against hers, the first thing she tastes is the turning of the seasons, the moment when dusk gives way to night. and then his kiss deepens. His teeth skim her bottom lip, and there is pain in the pleasure, followed by the copper taste of blood on her tongue.
"Done,"
whispers the god against her lips. And then the world goes black, and she is falling. Villon-sur-Salt, France, July 29th, 1714. 10. Adeline shivers. She looks down and sees that she is sitting on a bed of wet leaves. A second ago, she was falling, but only for a second, barely the length it takes to draw a breath. But time, it seems, has skipped ahead. The stranger is gone, and so are the last dregs of light. The summer sky, where it shows through the canopied trees, is smoothed to a velvet black, marked only by a low-hanging moon. Adeline rises, studying her hands, looking past the dirt for some sign of transformation. But she feels unchanged. A little dizzy, perhaps, as if she stood too quickly or drunk too much wine on an empty stomach. But after a moment, even that unsteadiness has passed, and she's left feeling as if the world has tipped, but not fallen, leaned and then rebalanced, settled back into the same old groove. She licks her lips, expecting to taste blood, but the mark left by the stranger's teeth is gone, swept away with every other trace of him. How does one know if a spell has worked? She asked for time, for life. Will she have to wait a year, or three, or five to see if age leaves any mark? Or take up a knife and cut into her skin to see if and how it heals? But no. She had asked for life, not a life unscathed, and if Adeline is being honest, she is afraid to test it, afraid to find her skin still too yielding, afraid to learn that the shadow's promise was a dream, or worse, a lie. But she knows one thing. Whether or not the deal was real, she will not heed the ringing church bells, will not marry Roger. She will defy her family. She will leave Villon if she must. She knows she will do whatever it takes now, because she was willing in the dark, and one way or another from this moment forward, her life will be her own. The thought is thrilling. Terrifying, but thrilling, as she leaves the forest. She is halfway across the field before she realizes how quiet the village is. How dark. The festive lanterns have been put out. The bells have stopped ringing. There are no voices calling her name. Adeline makes her way home, the dull dread growing a little sharper with every step. By the time she gets there, her mind is buzzing with worry. The front door hangs open, spilling light onto the path, and she can hear her mother humming in the kitchen, her father chopping wood around the side of the house. A normal night, made wrong by the fact it was not meant to be a normal night. "Mama," she says, stepping inside. A plate shatters to the floor, and her mother yelps, not in pain, but surprise, her face contorted. "What are you doing here?" she demands, and here is the anger Addie expected. Here is the dismay. "I'm sorry," she starts. "I know you must be mad, but I couldn't. Who are you?" The words are a hiss, and she realizes then that fearsome look on her mother's face is not the anger of a mother scorned, but that of a woman scared. "Mama," her mother cringes away from the very word. "Get out of my house!" But Adeline crosses the room, grabs her by the shoulders. "Don't be absurd. It's me, She is about to say Adeline. Indeed, she tries. Three syllables should not be such a mountain to climb, but she is breathless by the end of the first, unable to manage the second. The air turns to stone inside her throat, and she is left stifled, silent. She tries again, this time attempting Addie. Then at last, their family name, La Rue. But it is no use. The words meet an impasse between her mind and tongue. And yet, the second she draws breath to say another word, any other word, it is there, lungs filled and throat loose. "Let go," pleads her mother.
"What's this?"
demands a voice, low and deep. The voice that soothed Adeline on sick nights, that told her stories as she sat on the floor of his shop. Her father stands in the doorway, his arms full of wood.
Papa,
she says, and he draws back, as if the word were sharp.
The woman is mad,
sobs her mother.
Or cursed. I am your daughter,
she says again. Her father grimaces.
We have no child.
Those words, a duller knife, a deeper cut.
No,
says Adeline, shaking her head at the absurdity. She is 23, has lived every day and every night beneath this roof.
You know me.
How can they not? The resemblance between them has always been so keen. Her father's eyes, her mother's chin, one's brow and the other's lips, each piece clearly copied from its source. They see it too, they must. But to them, it is only proof of devilry. Her mother crosses herself, and her father's hands close around her, and she wants to sink into the strength of his embrace, but there is not warmth in it as he drags her to the door.
No,
she begs. Her mother is crying now, one hand to her mouth and the other clutching the wooden cross around her neck, as she calls her own daughter a demon, a monster, a demented thing, and her father says nothing, only grips her arm tighter as he pulls her from the house.
Be gone,
he says, the words half pleading. Sadness sweeps across his face, but not the kind that comes with knowing. No. It is the sadness reserved for lost things, a storm-torn tree, a horse made lame, a carving split one stroke before it's done.
Please, she begs. Papa!
His face hardens as he forces her out into the dark and slams the door. The bolt scrapes home. Adeline stumbles back, shaking with shock and horror. And then she turns and runs.
Estelle.
The name begins as a prayer, soft and private, and grows to a shout as Adeline nears the woman's cottage.
Estelle!
A lamp is lit within, and by the time she reaches the edge of the light, the old woman stands in the open doorway, waiting for her caller.
Are you a stranger or a spirit?
Estelle asks warily.
I am neither,
says Adeline, though she knows how she must look. Her dress tattered, her hair wild, streaming words like witchcraft on the step.
I am flesh and blood and human, and I have known you all my life. You make charms in the shape of children to keep them well in winter. You think peaches are the sweetest fruit, and that church walls are too thick for prayers to get through, and you want to be buried not beneath a stone, but in a patch of shade under a large tree.
Something flashes across the old woman's face, and Adeline holds her breath, hoping it is recognition, but it is too brief.
You are a clever spirit, says Estelle, but you will not cross this hearth.
I am not a spirit,
shouts Adeline, storming into the light of the old woman's door.
You taught me about the old gods and all the ways to summon them, but I made a mistake. They wouldn't answer, and the sun was going down so fast.
She wraps her arms tight around her ribs, unable to stop shaking.
I prayed too late, and something answered, and now everything is wrong.
Foolish girl,
chides Estelle, sounding like herself, sounding as if she knows her.
What do I do? How do I fix it?
But the old woman only shakes her head.
The darkness plays its own game,
she says.
It makes its own rules, she says. And you have lost.
And with that, Estelle draws back into her house.
Wait!
Calls Adeline as the old woman shuts the door. The bolt drives home. Adeline hurls herself against the wood, sobbing until her legs give way and she sinks to her knees on the cold stone step, one fist still pounding against the wood. And then, suddenly, the bolt draws back. The door swings open and Estelle stands over her.
What is this?
She asks, surveying the girl folded on her steps. The old woman looks at her as if they've never met. The moments before erased by an instant and a closed door. Her wrinkled gaze flicks over the stained wedding dress, the wild hair, the dirt under her nails, but there's no knowing in her face, only a guarded curiosity.
Are you a spirit or a stranger?
Adeline squeezes her eyes shut. What is happening? Her name is still a rock lodged deep, and when she was a spirit, she was banished, so she swallows hard and answers, "A stranger." Tears begin to slide down Adeline's face. "Please," she manages. "I have nowhere to go." The old woman looks at her for a long moment and then nods.
"Wait here," she says, slipping back into the house,
and Adeline will never know what Estelle was going to do then because the door swings shut and stays shut, and she is left kneeling on the ground, trembling more from shock than cold. She doesn't know how long she sits there, but her legs are stiff when she forces them to bear her weight. She rises and walks past the old woman's house to the line of trees beyond, past their sentinel's edge into the crowded dark.
"Show yourself!" she calls out.
But there is only the ruffle of feathers, the crackle of leaves, the ripple of a forest disturbed in sleep. She conjures his face, those green eyes, those black curls, tries to will the darkness into shape again, but moments pass and she is still alone. "I do not want to belong to anyone." Adeline walks deeper into the forest. This is a wilder stretch of wood, the floor a nest of bramble and brush. It claws at her bare legs, but she doesn't stop, not until the trees have closed around her, their branches blotting out the moon overhead.
"I call on you!" she screams.
"I am not some genie bound to your whim." A low limb, half buried by the forest floor, rises just enough to catch her feet, and she goes down hard, knees hitting ragged earth and hands tearing through weedy soil. "Please, I will give anything." The tears come then, sudden and heaving. "Fool, fool, fool." She pounds her fists against the ground. "This is a vile trick," she thinks, "a horrid dream. But it will pass." That is the nature of dreams. They do not last. "Wake up," she whispers into the dark. "Wake up." Adeline curls into the forest floor, closes her eyes, and sees her mother's tear-stained cheeks, her father's hollow sadness, Estelle's weary gaze. She sees the darkness smiling. Hears his voice as he whispers that single, binding word. "Done." New York City, March 10th, 2014. 11. A frisbee lands in the grass nearby. Addie hears the rumble of running feet and opens her eyes in time to see a giant black nose rushing at her face before the dog covers her in wet kisses. She laughs and sits up, runs her fingers through thick fur, catching the dog by his collar before he can get a hold of the paper bag with the second muffin. "Hello, you," she says as, across the park, someone calls out an apology. She flings the frisbee back in their direction, and the dog is off again. Addie shivers, suddenly wide awake and cold. That's the trouble with March. The warmth never lasts. There's that narrow stretch when it parades as spring, just enough for you to thaw if you're sitting in the sun, but then it's gone. The sun has moved on. The shadows have swept in. Addie shivers again and pushes up from the grass, brushing off her leggings. She should have stolen warmer pants. Shoving the paper bag in her pocket, Addie tucks Fred's book under her arm and abandons the park, heading east down Union and up toward the waterfront. Halfway there, she stops at the sound of a violin, the notes picked out like ripened fruit. On the sidewalk, a woman perches on a stool, the instrument tucked beneath her chin. The melody is sweet and slow, drawing Addie back to Marseille, to Budapest, to Dublin. A handful of people gather to listen, and when the song ends, the sidewalk fills with soft applause and passing bodies. Addie digs the last change out of her pocket and drops it into the open case and carries on, lighter and fuller. When she reaches the theater in Cobble Hill, she checks the posted timetable and then pushes open the door, quickening her pace as she crosses the crowded lobby. "Hey," Addie says, flagging down a teen boy with a broom. "I think I left my purse in Theater 3. Lying is easy, so long as you choose the right words. He waves her on without looking up, and she ducks beneath the velvet ticket taker's rope and into the darkened hall, the urgency falling away with every step. Muted thunder rolls beneath the doors of an action film. Music seeps into the hall from a romantic comedy. The highs and lows of voices and scores. She ambles down the corridor, studying the Coming Soon posters and the ticker tapes announcing the showings above each door. She's seen them all a dozen times, but she doesn't care. The credits must be rolling on number 5 because the doors swing open and a stream of people spill out into the corridor. Addie ducks past them, into the emptying room, and finds an overturned bucket of popcorn in the second row, golden pebbles littering the sticky floor. She scoops it up and marches back to the lobby and the concession stand, waits in line behind a trio of preteen girls before reaching the counter and the boy behind it. She runs a hand through her hair, mussing it slightly, and blows out her breath. "I'm sorry," she says. "Some little boy kicked over my popcorn." She shakes her head, and so does he, a mimic, echoing her exasperation. "Is there any way you could charge me the refill cost instead of—" She is already reaching in her pocket, as if to pull out a wallet, but the boy takes the bucket. "Don't worry about it," he says, glancing around. "I've got you." Addie beams. "You're a star," she says, meeting his eyes, and the boy blushes fiercely and stammers that it's really no problem, no problem at all, even as he scans the lobby for a superior. He dumps out the rest of the spilled popcorn and fills it fresh, passing it like a secret back across the counter. "Enjoy your show." Of all the inventions Addie has seen ushered into the world, steam-powered trains, electric lights, photography, and phones, and airplanes, and computers, movies might just be her favorite one. Books are wonderful, portable, lasting, but sitting here in the darkened theater, the widescreen filling her vision, the world falls away, and for a few short hours, she is someone else, plunged into romance and intrigue and comedy and adventure, all of it complete with 4K picture and stereo sound. A quiet heaviness fills her chest when the credits roll. For a while, she was weightless, but now she returns to herself, sinking until her feet are back on the ground. By the time Addie gets out of the theater, it is almost 6, and the sun is going down. She winds her way back through the tree-lined streets, past the park, the market now shuttered and the stalls already gone, and toward the rusted green table at the other edge. Fred is still sitting there in his chair, reading M. The pattern of spines on the table has shifted a little, an empty space here where a book has sold, a new rise there where another has been added. The light is getting low, and soon he'll have to go in, pack up the boxes and carry them one by one back into the house and up the 2 floors to his 1 bedroom. Addie has offered many times to help, but Fred insists on doing it himself. Another echo of Estelle, stubborn as stale bread. Addie crouches down beside the table and rises with the borrowed book in hand as if it had simply fallen off the end. She sets it back, careful not to upset the stack, and Fred must be at a good spot in the story because he grunts without ever looking up at her, or the book, or the paper bag she sets on top, the one with the chocolate chip muffin inside. It's the only kind he likes. Candace always gave him hell for his sweet tooth, he told Addie one morning, said it would kill him, but life's a bitch with a crooked sense of humor, 'cause she's gone and he's still eating shit. His words, not hers. The temperature is falling, and Addie tucks her hands in her pockets and wishes Fred a good night before continuing down the block, her back to the low sun and her shadow long ahead. It's dark by the time Addie gets to the alleyway, one of those places that seems to relish its status as a dive bar, a reputation tarnished by the fact it's become a favorite among headliners who want that Brooklyn feel. A handful of people mill around on the curb, smoking, chatting, waiting for friends, and Addie lingers among them a moment. She bums a cigarette just to have something to do, resisting the easy draw of the door for as long as she can, that tipping sense of the familiar, déjà vu. She knows this road, knows where it leads. Inside, the alleyway is shaped like a bottle of whiskey, the narrow stem of the entry, the dark wooden bar widening to a room of tables and chairs. She takes a seat at the counter. The man on her left buys her a drink, and she lets him.
"Let me guess," says the man. "A rosé?"
And she thinks of ordering whiskey just to see the surprise on his face, but that was never her drink. She's always gone for sweet. "Champagne." He orders, and they make small talk until he gets a call and steps away, promising to be right back. She knows he won't, is grateful for it as she sips her drink and waits for Toby to go on stage. He takes a seat, one knee up to steady his guitar, and flashes that bashful smile, almost apologetic. He hasn't learned yet how to take up space, but she's sure he will. He looks out at the small crowd before he starts to play, and Addie closes her eyes and lets herself vanish into the music. He plays a few covers, one of his own folk tunes, and then this. The first chords float through the alleyway, and Addie is back in his place. She is sitting at the piano, coaxing out notes, and he is there beside her, fingers folded over hers. It is coming together now. Words wrapped over melody. It is becoming his. It is like a tree taking root. He will remember on his own, not her, of course, not her, but this, their song. It ends, the music replaced by applause, and Toby sidles up to the bar, orders a Jack and Coke because they'll give it to him for free, and somewhere between the first sip and the third, he sees her. And smiles, and for an instant, Addie thinks, hopes even now that he remembers something, because he looks at her as if he knows her, but the truth is simply that he wants to. Attraction can look an awful lot like recognition in the wrong light. "Sorry," Toby says, head ducking the way it does whenever he's embarrassed, the way it did that morning when he found her in his living room. Someone brushes Addie's shoulder as they reach past her for the bar door. She blinks, and the dream falls away. She has not gone in. She is still standing on the street, the cigarette burned away to nothing between her fingers. A man holds open the door.
"You coming in?"
Addie shakes her head and forces herself to step back, away from the door and the bar and the boy about to take the stage. "Not tonight," she says. The rise isn't worth the fall. New York City, March 10th, 2014. 12. Night settles over Addie as she crosses the Brooklyn Bridge. The promise of spring has retreated like a tide, replaced again by a damp winter chill, and she pulls her jacket close, breath fogging as she starts the long stretch up the length of Manhattan. It would be easy enough to take the subway, but Addie has never liked being underground, where the air is close and stale, the tunnels too much like tombs. Being trapped, buried alive, these are the things that scare you when you cannot die. Besides, she doesn't mind walking, knows the strength of her own limbs, relishes the kind of tired she used to dread. Still, it's late, and her cheeks are numb, her legs weary by the time she reaches the Baxter on 56th. A man in a trim gray coat holds the door, and her skin tingles at the sudden flush of central heat as she steps into the Baxter's marble lobby. She is already dreaming of a hot shower and a soft bed, already moving toward the open elevator when the man behind the desk rises from his seat.
Good evening, he says. Can I help you?
I'm here to see James, she says, without slowing. 23rd floor.
The man frowns.
He isn't in.
Even better,
she says, stepping into the elevator.
Ma'am,
he calls, starting after her.
You can't just...
But the doors are already closing. He knows he will not make it, is already turning back toward the desk, reaching for the phone to call security. And that is the last thing she sees before the doors slide shut between them. Perhaps he will get the phone to his ear, even begin to dial before the thought slips from his mind, and then he will look down at the receiver in his hand and wonder what he was thinking, apologize profusely to the voice on the line, before sinking back into his seat. The apartment belongs to James St. Clair. They had met at a coffee shop downtown a couple months ago. The seats were all taken when he came over, wisps of blonde escaping the hem of a winter hat, glasses fogging from the cold. That day, Addie was Rebecca, and before he'd even introduced himself, James had asked if he could share her table, saw that she was reading Colette's Cherie, and managed a few lines of broken, blushing French. He sat, and soon easy smiles gave way to easy conversation. Funny how some people take an age to warm, and others simply walk into every room as if it's home. James was like that, instantly likable. When he asked, she said that she was a poet, an easy lie, as no one ever asked for proof, and he told her he was between jobs, and she nursed her coffee for as long as she could, but eventually her cup was empty, and so was his, and new customers were circling, buzzard-like, in search of chairs. But when he began to rise, she'd felt that old familiar sadness. And then James asked if she liked ice cream. And even though it was January, the ground outside slicked with ice and paving salt, Addie said she did, and this time when they stood together. Now she types the 6-digit code into the keypad on his door and steps inside. The lights come on, revealing pale wood floors and clean marble counters, lush curtains, and furniture that still looks unused, a high-backed chair, a cream sofa, a table neatly stacked with books. She unzips her boots, steps out of them beside the door, and pads barefoot through the apartment, tossing her jacket over the arm of a chair. In the kitchen, she pours herself a glass of Merlot, finds a block of Gruyere in a fridge drawer and a box of gourmet crackers in the cupboard, carries her makeshift picnic into the living room, the city unfolding beyond the floor-to-ceiling windows. Addie sifts through his records, puts on a pressing of Billie Holiday, and retreats to the cream sofa, knees tucked up beneath her as she eats. She would love a place like this, a place of her own, a bed molded to her body, a wardrobe full of clothes, a home decorated with markers of the life she's lived, the material evidence of memory. But she cannot seem to hold on to anything for long. It is not as though she hasn't tried. Over the years, she's collected books, hoarded art, hidden fine dresses away in chests and locked them there. But no matter what she does, things always go missing. They vanish one by one, or all at once, stolen by some strange circumstance, or simply time. Only in New Orleans did she have a home, and even that was not hers, but theirs, and it is gone. The only thing she cannot seem to rid herself of is the ring. There was a time when she couldn't bear to part with it again, a time when she mourned its loss, a time when her heart soared to hold it so many decades later. Now, she cannot stand the sight of it. It is an unwelcome weight in her pocket, an unwanted reminder of another loss. And every time her fingers skim the wood, she feels the darkness kissing her knuckle as he slides the band back on. See? Now we are even. Addie shudders, upsetting her glass, and drops of red wine splash over the rim, landing like blood on the cream sofa. She does not curse, does not spring to her feet to fetch club soda and a towel. She simply watches as the stain soaks in and through and disappears, as if it was never there. As if she was never there. Addie rises and goes to run herself a bath, soaks away the city grime with scented oil, scrubs herself clean with $100 soap. When everything slips through your fingers, you learn to savor the feel of nice things against your palm. She settles back into the tub and sighs, breathing in a mist of lavender and mint. They went for ice cream that day, she and James, ate it inside the shop, heads bowed together as they stole toppings from each other's cups. His hat sat discarded on the table, his blonde curls on full display, and he was striking, yes, but it still took her a while to notice the looks. Addie was used to passing glances. Her features are sharp but feminine, her eyes bright above the constellation of freckles on her cheeks, a kind of timeless beauty, she's been told. But this was different. Heads were turning, gazes lingered. And when she wondered why, he looked at her with such cheerful surprise and confessed that he was, in fact, an actor in a show that was currently quite popular. He blushed when he said it, looked away, then back to study her face, as if braced for some fundamental change. But Addie has never seen his work, and even if she had, she is not one to blush at fame. She has lived too long and known too many artists. And even still, or perhaps more to the point, Addie prefers the ones who aren't yet finished, the ones still looking for their shape. And so, James and Addie carried on. She teased him about his loafers, his sweater, his wireframe glasses. He told her he was born in the wrong decade. She told him she was born in the wrong century. He laughed, and she didn't, but there was something old-fashioned in his manner. Only 26, but when he talked, he had the easy cadence, the slow precision of a man who knew the weight of his own voice, belonged to the class of young men who dressed like their fathers, the charade of those too eager to grow old. Hollywood had seen it too. He kept getting cast in period pieces. "I've got a face for sepia," he joked. Addie smiled. "Better than a face for radio." It was a lovely face, but there was something wrong, the too steady smile of a man with a secret. They made it through the ice cream before he came undone. That easy joy of his flickered and went out, and he dropped the plastic spoon down into the cup and closed his eyes and said, "I'm sorry." "What for?" she asked, and he flung himself back in his seat and ran his fingers through his hair. To the strangers on the street, it might have looked like such a careless gesture, a feline stretch, but she could see the anguish in his face as he said it. "You're so beautiful and kind and fun." "But," she pressed, sensing the turn, "I'm gay." The word like a hitch in his throat as he explained that there was so much pressure, that he hated the gaze of the media and all its demands, that people were beginning to whisper, to wonder, and he wasn't ready for them to know. Addie realized then that they were on a stage, propped before the plate glass windows of the ice cream shop for everyone to see. And James was still apologizing, saying that he shouldn't have flirted, shouldn't have used her in this way. But she wasn't really listening. His blue eyes went somewhat glassy as he spoke, and she wondered if this was what he called on when the script ordered tears, if this was the place he went. Addie has secrets too, of course, though she cannot help but keep them. Still, she knows what it's like to have a truth erased. "I understand," he was saying, "if you want to go." But Addie didn't stand up, didn't reach for her coat. She simply leaned in and stole a blueberry from the edge of his bowl. "I don't know about you," she said lightly, "but I'm having a lovely day." James let out a shaky breath, blinking away tears, and smiled. "So am I," he said, and things were better after that. It is so much easier to share a secret than to keep one. And when they stepped outside again, hand in hand, they were conspirators, made giddy by their private knowledge. She was not worried about being noticed, being seen, knew that if there were photos, they would never turn out. There were photos, but her face was always conveniently in motion or obscured, and she remained a mysterious girl in the tabloids for the next week until the headlines inevitably moved on to juicier fare. They had come back here, to his apartment at the Baxter, for a drink. His tables were covered in a flurry of books and papers, all relating to the Second World War. He was preparing for a role, he told her, reading every first-hand account he could find. He showed them to her, these printed reproductions, and Addie said that she'd been fascinated by the war, that she knew a few stories, told them as if they were someone else's, a stranger's experience instead of her own. James listened, folded into the corner of the cream sofa, his eyes pressed shut, and a glass of whiskey balanced on his chest as she spoke. They fell asleep side by side in the king-sized bed, in the shadow of each other's warmth, and the next morning, Addie woke before dawn and slipped away, sparing them both the discomfort of a goodbye. She has the sense that they would have been friends, if he'd remembered. She tries not to think about that. She swears sometimes her memory runs forward as well as back, unspooling to show the roads she'll never get to travel. But that way lies madness, and she has learned not to follow. Now, she is back here, and he is not. Addie wraps herself in one of James's plush, terry robes and throws open the French doors, stepping out onto the bedroom balcony. The wind is up, the cold stinging the soles of her bare feet. The city sprawls around her like a low night sky full of artificial stars, and she shoves her hands into the pockets of the robe and feels it, resting on the bottom of the empty fold. A small circle of smooth wood. She sighs, closes her hand around the ring and draws it out, leans her elbows on the balcony and forces herself to look at the band in her open palm, to study it, as if she has not already memorized every warp and whirl. She traces the curve with her free hand, resists the urge to slip the band onto her finger. She has thought of it, of course, in darker moments, tired moments, but she will not be the one to break. She tips her hand and lets the ring fall over the edge of the balcony, down, down into the dark. Back inside, Addie pours herself another glass of wine and climbs into the magnificent bed, folds herself beneath the down duvet and between the Egyptian sheets, and wishes she'd gone into the alleyway. Wishes that she'd sat at the bar and waited for Toby with his messy curls and shy smile. Toby, who smells of honey and plays bodies like instruments and takes up so much space in bed.